we were recovering from our shock that he just said, well, make your own radio station. And he said something like, isn't that sort of obvious? You know, didn't you know that's how they happen? You see, he acted like this is a matter of course. Yeah, you want a new radio station? You just make one. Want it to be an NPR station? Well, you just call NPR and say, sign me up. And now you got you an NPR radio station, you know, by next Thursday.
The voice of Malcolm Spencer Brown, co-founder of WJFF Radio Catskill. He passed away earlier this month at the age of 84. Coming up on Radio Catskill this morning, we are going to hear more of that interview, conducted in 2015 as part of WJFF's 25th anniversary. Malcolm will tell the story of how he came to this area and how the station got off the ground in his own words.
If I could call myself a horse, it's from the horse's mouth.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. There were no major protests or unrest in Kenosha following the acquittal of Kyle Rittenhouse on all the charges against him, but hundreds turned out in Brooklyn.
Ain't no justice in this town.
Ain't no justice in this town.
Ain't no justice in this town.
In Portland, Oregon, police declared a riot after a demonstration in the city's downtown turned violent. Local media say the riot was declared after protesters started breaking windows and throwing objects at police. Rittenhouse supporters, meanwhile, are celebrating a victory, saying he had a right to defend himself. Federal health officials have given the green light to opening COVID-19 booster shots to all American adults. CDC Director Rochelle Walensky signed off on the move last night. The decision simplifies the guidance on boosters as the holiday travel season approaches. For anyone 18 or older, officials now say the only requirement is to be at least 6 months past the last dose of a Pfizer or Moderna shot, or 2 months past the single-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine. With coronavirus infections spiking in many parts of Europe, thousands gathered in Vienna today to protest Austria's move to implement a nationwide lockdown and make vaccinations mandatory next year. Protests turned violent in the Dutch city of Rotterdam last night. Terry Schultz reports.
Hundreds of people rioted against Dutch lockdown measures in Rotterdam in what city police called a serious crisis. Local television showed cars and other vehicles set on fire. Police say they were forced to shoot at protesters in self-defense. Rotterdam Mayor Ahmed Abu Talib announced dozens of arrests. Demonstrations against coronavirus restrictions have been regular occurrences in the Netherlands, which saw a record high number of infections Thursday. The latest violence was sparked by a new government proposal that only those who've been vaccinated or can prove recovery from the virus and not just test negative would be able to use the national health pass for access to public places. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz.
Auto giant Ford and the electric startup Rivian no longer planning to work together on electric vehicles, although Ford remains an investor in its new rival. NPR's Camila Domonoski reports.
Ford and Rivian are each making their own electric vehicles, but they also had plans for a joint project, which is now canceled. Rivian called the decision mutual. Ford CEO Jim Farley told Automotive News the decision reflects Ford's growing confidence in its own electric ambitions. He just announced he's doubling plans for electric production. It's not uncommon for rival automakers to work together on vehicles or even own stakes in each other. Ford is still an investor in Rivian, and that investment has paid off handsomely. The electric startup stock has soared since it went public last week. Camila Domonoski, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR News.
This is Ari Shapiro from NPR. If working from home is your new routine and you've got a car you don't need anymore, consider donating it to this station. It could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thank you.
Go to WJFFradio.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Radio Catskill. I'm your host, Jason Dole. We have a special presentation on this morning's program. Malcolm Brown, co-founder of WJFF Radio Catskill, passed away on November 3rd, and he was 84. Now, back in 2015, Malcolm sat down with me for a lengthy interview about the history of WJFF and his role in getting it started. And this was on the occasion of the station's 25th anniversary of going on air. We're going to hear most of that conversation this morning as we remember Malcolm, honor his life, and reflect on all that he helped bring to this region when he helped breathe life into this radio station, the one you're listening to right now. So thank you for joining us today.
I think maybe briefly just ask how it was that you found yourself in Sullivan County.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, there certainly were a number of stages. I had myself a burdensome, you might say, or at least not a light burden, full-time position at Brooklyn College. I guess what you'd call it is a tenured full professor type position. I'd been there for 15 years teaching philosophy and teaching a little bit at the Graduate Center also on 42nd Street. But Brooklyn was my main location. Anyway, I had some friends who were beekeepers, and in fact, they were something that seems paradoxical. In fact, various of the pieces of this puzzle have the element of paradox.
Brooklyn beekeepers?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, these are urban, right? Urban beekeepers, and it was faintly illegal, I think you might say, or I think quite a bit has progressed and become more beekeeper friendly in the past 35 years. But anyway, the two of us, well, there were more than two of us, but two chief people, one who's in Sullivan County now, who's Maria Grimaldi, and I, were both Brooklyn College connected people. We were both connected to the botany department, not very closely in my case, and in hers, a closer connection. But now the botanists had a very clear recognition of how bees and flowers get together. You know that one about it?
They better.
You got to learn about that stuff one way or another. Now, she was familiar with, she would say, you know where Youngsville is. Several people lowered that on me at some stage. And my short answer was no. You know, there is a way of answering the question, do you know where Youngsville is? And my then answer was, no, I don't know where it is. But people were using Youngsville as a reference point, you see. So, and this is a common phenomenon, isn't it, you see. Of course, you know where Larissa is and the road to Larissa and all that stuff. People say, where's Larissa? Those directions are no good. But anyway, Maria not only knew where Youngsville was, but she knew things about shopping for real estate up there, and she knew about honeybees, and she knew about the fact that you were a little bit better off as a beekeeper, particularly if you wanted to have 10 or 15 colonies. And down in Brooklyn, we would tend to have one colony, you know, in a particular location. And the particular location we had was just outside the greenhouse on the roof of the science building that had a botany department in it. So, but you can do urban beekeeping in a serious way. Manhattan is a very good place to do beekeeping, like 113th Street near Broadway.
What, because of the trees?
Or? Yeah, exactly. You got your finger right on it. It's trees. It's trees. Trees are wonderful in the sense of, picture a clover field, and you have at a maximum maybe ankle-high vegetation. Now picture a linden tree or a basswood tree or Tilia americana is a way to say Lindenbaum. It's a wonderful city shade tree. Parks people know about the Lindenbaums. But beekeepers know about the Lindenbaums because they are prolific honey producers. And now coming back to that ankle-high vegetation, Lindenbaums are not limited to the height of one's ankle. You can get them 40 and 50 feet high. And now that means you got just not a field down at your ankle level. You got levels and levels of fields up 40 and 50 feet in the air. And bees get so enthusiastic. This I learned from some beekeepers in southern Illinois. So carried away, so to speak, with the odor and flavor of the nectar of these trees, that they're said to come out at night when you have a full moon yes, and shop for nectar. Now, that's a piece of lore that I have that could possibly be rejected angrily by good apiculturalists. But I certainly did hear it from one very responsible beekeeper man who put three kids through college on honey. So he said yes. It had to be special circumstances. It had to be nice and warm. The moon had to be nice and bright. And the bees had to be in the mood. But that makes Lindenbaums very, very attractive honey producers. But anyway, the Brooklyn College campus was loaded with tilia. Central Park's loaded with tilia. That's where 113th Street bees would get their honey. And they can go 3 and 4 miles easily. Okay, anyway, bees.
The beekeepers are what pointed you northward?
They were. The idea is, why do urban beekeeping when you can do beekeeping in the countryside, where there's maybe more understanding, more toleration, more friendliness, more bee-friendly people? So I did set up 21 colonies in Hortonville in early 1981, well before Jeff Hydro got going, and even more so before Jeff Radio got going. But we had Ann Larson joined the movement and came up to the country, formed a central part of Brown's Hortonville Honey. But she was funny even then, and you know, this has remained a characteristic of her very steadily. She would speak her mind very openly and very clearly about whatever was in her mind, so that one particular customer who came back with an outrageous frequency, I mean, he kept buying honey and buying more honey and stuff, she took him aside and said, "Jeff, are you sure you want to, are you eating all this?" And so she didn't chide him, but she gave him a bit of listener feedback, so to speak.
Don't overdo it on
yeah,
the honey.
Yeah. Don't overdo this honey. But I don't know. He may have been distributing it to family and other things. He may have been doing very sensible things with it other than eating it. Anyhow, she was a very central part of that. And steadily and right along, she understood what might be interesting about doing hydropower. As, for instance, on North Branch Creek, we started out thinking of, there was a little cider mill there in the little village of North Branch. And it was just downstream of a little dam. And once you hear about a little dam, you say, well, a little dam could have, that's an impoundment in the lingo, right? Or a pond. Mm-hmm. Okay, now that pond or impoundment has some vertical head, right? The lake level or the pond level is higher than the outlet level. Well, that invites you to put in a water turbine. And water power is very far from an unknown thing here in Western Sullivan County. There were mills everywhere you went, through little dams and little mills. Some of them pressed cider, some of them did sawing of lumber and so forth.
More in the old days than the modern era.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. It had, many of these things had tapered off for various economic reasons. And then you factor in regulatory constraints of various kinds, you know, the things that didn't exist back when those early cider mills were going on, like the Department of Environmental Conservation. Well, now they come along and say, well, you want to think a little bit about flood control, you want to think about dam safety and so forth. And so things got more regulated in the course of time.
So you guys were in Hortonville,
mm-hmm.
making honey.
We were.
Eyeballing the potential for making power with water.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then that led you to a 1920s dam in Jeffersonville.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because, you see, we were a little upstream of the confluence of the North Branch and the East Branch of Calicoon Creek.
So you followed things upstream until you got to this one?
Exactly. Well, no, I had a lot of help there because, you know, doing research on things that are a little bit pardon the expression, recherché, but they're in need of research, is one of the things I've done all my life, really, or at least all of my grown-up life, because I took on a task relating to Plato's academy, his early academy, about which a great deal is known, and curious enough, a great deal remains unknown. It's quite a surprise. In any case, a recherché point about drainage areas and dams is something that I don't think it was the DEC exactly, but it was a state agency. Certainly the DEC was involved in producing a massive database. This was at a time when we're talking now 70s and so forth, when you didn't just every time you took a right turn, you found a new database, right? I mean, obviously, we're not talking about any World Wide Web, or right?
Yeah.
We're talking about, I call these all prehistoric times.
Somebody's writing something down somewhere.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And now it was, mercifully enough, it was computerized at least, you know. It,
oh, okay.
We're not back to Babbage and computers needing to be invented, but things were a tad primitive, so that you needed a paper printout, right? You certainly didn't, you know, beam it on any web or, you know, get a CD, or you didn't get an electronic copy of this database. You went to Brooklyn Polytech, which is where this massive pile of paper printout was. Now, what was it a massive printout about? Well, it was sites around the state. It was a statewide study where there were existing dams, scores and scores at least, of serious dams, that's serious from the point of view of power generation around the state. Very early, now here you gotta do some research on your history, but you find that there was a tannery here in Jaff back in the 1870s. And the same people controlled Lake Briscoe, and there wasn't much of a Lake Jeff at the time, but there was a little bit of an impoundment here too. So back in those, you know, more prehistoric times, we're not just going back behind the World Wide Web, we're going back beyond the beginning of the 20th century. There are commemorative plaques around to town supervisors and so forth who would oftentimes be mill or tannery operators.
I tell people that may not know much about the history of the area to just look at the woods around here and realize that as rural as it is, those trees aren't as old as you think they might be. Any of the accessible hills that you might see or walk around. And there was a time when these hills were essentially bare. And bare, the white sure. pine was taken off and the sure. bark used for tanning. And
sure, and the hemlock.
And, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. you know, and the hemlock and the white pine was shipped downstream to, you know, build America, essentially.
Sure, all those trees got trimmed off. One very interesting anecdote, it comes down from Fred Schott Sr. He said, you know, in downtown Jeff, it would be the talk of the town on a given morning. If someone came in and said, you know what I saw this morning? I saw a deer. I saw a deer. And then it would spread. It would be rumor. Somebody saw a deer.
My grandfather seemed to indicate that he felt that World War II had something to do with the resurgence of the deer in our area. That prior to that, they were very scarce. And then after they started picking up a bit, and this is anecdotal, mm-hmm. Armchair biology,
sure.
but you know, he seemed to think that, you know, all the young men of a certain age are all gone from the area for a while, you know,
oh, okay.
off, you know, in the war that mm-hmm. Helped them resurge a bit. I don't know. There could have been mitigating environmental factors as well, and the fact mm-hmm. that the woods were on their way back at that point mm-hmm. would indicate mm-hmm. that too.
Sure,
but I've heard that too. I was shocked to hear that from my grandfather when he was a boy. Yeah. And there was hardly any deer.
Yeah, yeah. You see herds of deer, don't you now?
Oh, yeah.
You know, you don't talk about, I saw a deer.
Yeah, no.
You say you saw...
No, it's highway robbery. They stand in the road, make you stop, and then they mug you. You know, there's gangs of deer.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, history is an odd thing, isn't it? When you reconstruct it, and it's always an effort to go back and to, let's say, to have no World Wide Web or something, or to... that kind of thing. Or when a database was an unusual thing to bump into on a given morning. Yeah.
So you got this list of dams printed up.
Absolutely.
And you must have looked at this and said, one of these is right here in my backyard.
Look at this. It's called Jeffersonville, or it's called Lake Jefferson. You see, they think from, we're thinking drainage areas and all that stuff. We're thinking from a hydro point of view. And yes, its number is number 98, by the way. Yeah, 90, good old 98. I said, damn, 90. I didn't, pardon the pun. But that's the best number by a dam site. Number 98. Now, notice how strikingly superior a drainage area of 30.3 square miles is going to be than the drainage area of the little guy that pressed apples in North Branch, you know, on that tributary to Calicoon Creek.
So you found that dam there, like, and pretty soon it was yours?
Well, there were several steps, not all of them real easy, but a very key set of helping circumstances involved the name Schott, namely Frederick W.V. Schott, Sr. Fred Schott, Sr. had already been the mayor of Jeffersonville for about 30 years, I believe continuously and consecutively. And he was threatening to set a statewide record of how long can one mayor stay. And later, he didn't just threaten to do it. He did set the record. I think you'll find that today's New York State record may be held by F.W.V. Schott, Sr. Yeah, because I think he managed 40-some years in office, uninterrupted. Naturally, one didn't run against F.W.V. Schott. He wouldn't make any history that way.
No, I can see how he could be a valuable supporter.
Absolutely. And see, he forgave me for being from outside. Now, there's a familiar phenomenon which is called xenophobia in the old language. And a xenos is just somebody from out of town, right? And I was a classic xenos. Here I was running around with what I could manage of a Brooklyn accent. And so I was a clearly marked outsider guy. But F.W.V. Schott, as I say, forgave me, or he didn't pay attention to that difference between insider and outsider, which by the way, is I would say it became one of the central parts of the mission of WJFF Radio. We now, jumping to Ann Larson and myself, we articulated that rather early. We said one of the reasons we're here is to cause a disappearance of something, namely, or a disappearance of a number of things, namely lines of demarcation. Like we used to hear about an invisible line that ran north-south through White Sulphur Springs. But east of that invisible line, you see, those were sort of bad people. Those are people you didn't want to associate with. Those are the other. See, those are the Xenoi. Those are the people who weren't from here, okay? And then if you got on the other side of the line, you say, yeah, but those people on the other side of that invisible line, those are kind of bad people. They're the people that aren't from here, you see? So let's say you're from Hurleyville. You say, oh, my goodness, you don't want to cross that boundary, you know? Yeah.
So that's where the mission came up with these notions. That's skipping ahead, but I mean, in that mission was the notion of, well, we're going to connect people to a wider world of ideas, and just as much as we preserve the culture of this area here. So we're going to connect this listening area to itself and to the rest of the world.
Sure, sure. And the bigger the world, the better, you know. If it includes Bulgaria, good. never mind, Bulgaria hasn't heard a lot about us yet, but maybe one day they will.
Right.
Or Germany hasn't. But certainly it wasn't too, or Japan. We had people, I mean, I'm sitting here in the studio looking across Calicoon Creek, meaning the East Branch, and seeing Swiss Hill, right? Swiss Hill is directly across. We had people from Japanese national radio climbing around on that hill at moderate risk to their safety and well-being because it's a rather steep hill, but they had cameras. And they were explaining to us that they had a designated day in the year called Electricity Day. So they wanted to see about electricity as it was generated here at the Lake Jeff Dam, you see.
And they're trying to get a good shot of it?
They're trying to get a good shot of it, which is not the easiest thing because it's a rather steep hill.
We're listening to a special interview recorded with Malcolm Brown in 2015, co-founder of WJFF Radio Catskill. We're going to take a quick break right now. When we return, we'll hear the second half of this conversation. This is Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill's annual music sale returns to the White Sulphur Springs Fire Hall Saturday, November 27th. We have records, CDs, stereo equipment, musical instruments, and more. Bid on rare and collectible items at the silent auction table. Browse through bins of vinyl priced to move. The WJFF Music Sale, November 27th. Doors open at 11. Sale goes to 3. Info at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Jason Dole. We're going to continue now with our conversation with Malcolm Brown. This was recorded in 2015. Malcolm is a co-founder of WJFF Radio Catskill. Malcolm was the co-founder of WJFF Radio Catskill. He passed away on November 3rd at the age of 84.
Try to put yourself in the moment. There was a point where there was a house and there's a dam and there's Jeff Hydro and there is no radio station.
No Jeff Radio, no.
And there isn't even the thought of a radio station.
That's true, that's
and
true.
And I was wondering if you can pin down when it is that thought entered your mind.
It's a story that's been told often enough that for me and Ann at least, it becomes a little bit repetitious. But I realize that for many members of the public, you know, it's not that repetitious, but...
Well, not only that, okay. Though, I'm bringing in here to try to find out how much of it's true. To what extent this is a tall tale or apocryphal come on. Any way. That's why I'm going to the source here.
Well, let me tell you, I can...
Because I've heard it too, but not from you.
I guess, okay. Well, this is, if I could call myself a horse, it's from the horse's mouth.
A Jeff Horse,
Jeff Horse. No, there are nameable and dateable people and events. There's a Jennifer Mazur who is the wife of Joe Mazur, and Joe Mazur is a slightly far-out mathematician who teaches at Marlborough College in Vermont, which is a slightly far-out college. It's somewhere near Bennington. Jennifer and Joe and their two kids were visiting our premises here. And Joe and I had done quite a bit in the scholarly line together. Joe was a very enterprising, even entrepreneurial kind of professor. And so he gets people together. He's a very skillful bringer together of people who have sometimes a bit, jumping back to that idea of recherche, you know, out-of-the-way knowledge, like about the early Pythagoreans. He can get you together half a dozen experts on early Pythagoreanism, even though we're a rather rare breed. But Joe is very good that way. But anyway, they said, okay, it's this evening, Garrison Keillor comes on the radio. We said, oh, does he? I don't know, we might have said, who's Garrison Keillor? But I don't think we said that. But we knew who we didn't have, Garrison Keillor. But we had to let him down easy. We said, Joe, I know your whole family, all four of you, want to listen to this thing called Prairie Home Companion, this relatively new thing. You know, it's a new show. Who knows how long it'll last? And it's a new talent on the horizon, Garrison Keillor, right? Who knows how long he'll last? Well, alas, you came to a place which is tucked away in certain hilly piece of terrain near the Delaware River, and we can't get the signal here. You know, we can't bring him in these particular hills. You can't get him. Okay, but he he came back expressing astonishment. He said, wait, no, my understanding is that everybody gets Garrison Keillor. There's nobody in any corner of the world who can't get Garrison Keillor. But what he was operating from, you see, was Vermont Public Radio. There's a statewide network in Vermont, you see. So never mind they got Mounds, you see. They were able, even at that stage of technology, you see, via tapes, you know, etc. There were resourceful local folks, like ourselves. We became resourceful local folks ourselves. And there were satellite dishes, right? It wasn't that far back in history.
Right.
They didn't have those. So we said, I'm sorry, Joe, you know, we would just gonna have to do without. And he said, well, now, if I were in your shoes, says Joe, he's talking like a mathematician, you know, who can create worlds out of numbers and all that stuff. He said, by next Thursday, I think you should have your own public radio station right here, you know. And then you see, we could all listen, all four of us. So you could listen to this guy, this new phenomenon, Garrison Keillor. This struck us as a slightly fantastical idea. You see, so you're saying that because you in the state of Vermont have a whole statewide network, then we here in Jeffersonville can just say, okay, we'll pretend we're a whole state and set it up so we can get Garrison Keillor. But a little easier said than done, right? But we did have Hydro, and he didn't have any difficulty connecting the idea of you could power a station that you put right here.
And was that part of the conversation that day, that evening?
Now, you know, that's something you might want to check with Ann as to whether that came in, that connection. But I think it did. I think it did. It certainly is true that there was a pre-existing idea in both of our heads that there's something a little ho-hum about creating the equivalent of 25 or 26 households worth of electricity and just saying, here, you figure out what to do with it. In other words, we'll spin a meter with it. You see, we'll spin a meter.
You were starting to think a little bit about, well, what else could we do with this?
Sure,
What good can come of this electricity that we're making?
Sure. What? Yeah.
Do you recall anything about the next steps that happened from that evening where this idea came up, like, well, there's no kind of public radio here to actually creating public radio in Jeffersonville? Like,
well, there is a particular story that Ann delights in retelling, and maybe you could get it from her in her words, but I won't be speaking untruthfully. I'll just be speaking maybe a little inelegantly compared to what she would do. But I used what we used to call a phone book, right? And I called what we used to call long distance. Imagine long distance, you dial 202. You're gonna pay something if you call 202, right? That's not 607 or, I mean, you know, that's 202. That's a long ways away. Yes, I got on the phone having figured out how would we communicate with NPR, right? Now, because NPR is, you know, a big, serious, ambitious, nationwide thing, right? So these are the people we need to talk to and say,
let's go to the top. And,
yeah, right. Yeah, and how do you move from there? Oh, I don't think I quoted Joe Mazur. You know, we were recovering from our shock that he just said, well, make your own radio station. And but then he said something like, isn't that sort of obvious, what is needed? You know, just do it. You know, come on, you know, get off your tail, so to speak. Make your own radio station. Didn't you know that's how they happen? You see, he acted like this is a matter of course. Yeah, you want a new radio station? You just make one. And you say, I want it to be an NPR station. Well, you just call NPR and say, sign me up. And now you got you an NPR radio station, you know, by next Thursday. But we did realize that there were a few complications, probably.
But there's just that general notion of, like, oh, you could start a station. I mean, that was news to you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it hadn't come across our horizon, you know, at all. Yeah, but he said, yeah, just do it.
How long between that conversation and when you actually think, well, why don't I try calling the people at NPR?
You know, I don't know if it was more than 24 or 48 hours, because here's the part of the story that you really got to get from Ann Larson, because it's quite funny. And it's got some special twists to it. I got talking to somebody down there, you know, and I said, I'm in Jeffersonville, New York, and so forth. And we're thinking about seeing if we can't get a public radio station going. And here's what then happened. If I have my order right, I think I do. Ann Larson got a phone book, figured out, looked up NPR, said, I'm going to call these people and ask, what would be the next steps? The person on the other end said, my God, Jeffersonville, a guy just called. Somebody just called and said he wanted to set up a radio station in Jeffersonville. Sometimes we were news in Washington by the time Ann had called. Unless I called second and she called first, I can't recall which was first. I would trust Ann's recollection on this one. One of us got this astonished sound, you know, a little dead air on the other end of the phone.
This has always been like, you know, it's a story, but I didn't know if it was true.
Oh, yeah.
Like this is how it went down.
One of the two versions is true. I mean, either A called before B or B before A, but they were absurdly close in time, you see. In other words, the idea was, what are these two rival groups, you know, in the same town? One trying to beat the other.
You can imagine somebody down in Washington saying, what's in the water up there in Jeffersonville? And given how it came to be, that's a relevant question. So you made that phone call, and you got the community together. People started raising funds.
Exactly.
Building a play. This took a few years.
There was a key thing that we did, namely we put a notice in the newspaper, and we asked a question to the readers. I think it was in the Sullivan County Democrat, but it was in one of the local newspapers. I think the Democrat. A display ad, and it said, would you like to set up our own public radio station? Come to a meeting if this interests you. And the meeting was at the Lake Jefferson Hotel, right on the borders of Lake Jeff, right?
So that's where you had your first meeting.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, and it surprised us. It surprised us, the organizers, the two organizers, and I think it surprised the people who turned out. You know, you look around, I guess it's like in a church. You look around and you say, why are all these pews filled up? You know, must be an interesting preacher coming. But an awful lot of people came.
So you're a bit surprised to see that type of a turnout.
Yeah.
What was the need, or what did you feel the people were looking for?
Well, you know, they seemed very ready to tell us the next steps in case we didn't see them. You know, namely, why don't you, you know, or the sense of the meeting was form groups here. You know, I mean, there'll be people who are interested in this. This is a complicated thing, right? This will take some doing. But maybe we need committees and, you know, groups. I mean, we need some fundraising. As you point out, you got to pass the hat, and you got to learn early how to do that. You got to do it often and well, right? So yeah, you got to have a fundraising committee. You got to have people responsible for programming. You know, what are you going to put up there? Because it isn't necessarily true that you're going to go with NPR, right? I mean, you could do different things.
How did the first shows get selected? How, you know, I mean, just the concept of there is no radio station, then there is, but just like there is no schedule, then all of a sudden you've got people that have radio shows. Like, how did that happen?
Well, you know, we had something resembling a programming committee, you know, and then there again, it will have had its roots back in that initial meeting, you know. But there, too, there are documents. They're scrawled on pieces of paper, you know. I mean, I got a mental picture of a very early, you know, the boxes and the time slots.
The grid, yeah.
The grid, there we go. Which offering, by the way, very interestingly appeared on the front page of the Sullivan County Democrat, and very much to the credit, the everlasting credit of the editor of that newspaper, whose name at the time was Fred Stabbert Jr., the father of Freddie Stabbert III, he had what we would call the wisdom and the foresight to say, these people are going to these people are real and they're going to stay around a while. You know,
they ran it right on the front. They decided to do that.
Ran it on the front page, yeah. That proved to be a hugely influential or impactful decision on Fred Jr.'s part in the following way, that when I was sitting in the little trailer of Charlie Cook, now Charlie Cook was a state senator, a very, very respected state senator from a rural part of New York State, namely right around here, who had the very, to my mind, very inspired thought, why don't I stay in close touch with my constituents? And he had a little, it was sort of like trailer talk, trailer. It was a very tiny trailer. And he would tug this around. He would go to Calicoon Depot, which is, as you know, Calicoon on the Delaware. Or he would go to Livingston Manor, or he would go to, you know, Roscoe. And he would sit down, and but he would announce it in the newspapers. Charlie Cook and his trailer will be there. Senator Cook, right? Now, I didn't know at the time that there was really a quite serious friendship and collegial linkage between Charlie Cook and Fred Stavert Jr. They had had a collegiality and friendship that went back, I imagine, decades. I don't know. That's what I've since heard. I didn't know it at the time. But anyway, I stepped into the little trailer, and I had a big three-ring binder with me, an extremely big three-ring binder. I could just barely lug it in there. But it had an Exhibit M in it. Now, the Exhibit M was letters. You see, this was people who wrote in and said, hey, this is grand. Imagine, our own radio station? Yeah, I like that for this and that reason. And I have the following resources. Like, for example, David Simpitas wrote in. The guy does electronically generated music. Now, there again, if you're going back to the late 80s, you're going back to, you know, times when maybe that was cutting edge and forward-thinking stuff. But anyway, his letter was in there. And one of the letters that was in there, by the way, was from an artist whose name is Alan D'Arcangelo. And I'm sitting there with Charlie Cook. I mean, I was just meeting him for the first time. He very agreeable guy, and he was the kind of guy who clearly sort of got some enjoyment out of talking to his constituents, which is a very refreshing thing.
Right. But why'd you go to the trailer?
Why'd I go to the trailer? Well, it's just because this guy who said, I'm Senator Cook and I represent you in Albany,
yeah,
was coming by and saying, I'm interested in you know, constituent input, right? Yeah. Now, I don't think I thought of any greedy thoughts like, could we get $25,000 or $30,000 of state money behind this organization? I don't think I thought that at the time. I mean, I knew it was good to be on very good terms with your state senator.
So you didn't go looking for something. You weren't looking for something in particular, but you're just trying to maintain good connections.
Yeah, I think I was that sort of public-spirited and non-greedy. I remember vividly his asking me, because I didn't understand the question. He said, how do you get along with the people over there? Now, I said, well, could you clarify, you know, what do you mean by the people over there? And he was pointing in the direction of the offices of the Sullivan County Democrat. Yeah. That's what he meant by over there. And he clarified that. He said, I mean the newspaper, you know, the local newspaper. Yeah. How do you get along with the people? I didn't know that he was medium to close friends with the editor and publisher of the people over there. You know, but I remember being able to snap back briskly, like I was then, you know, capable of brisk repartee. I've slowed down a bit recently. But I said something to the effect, egad, not only we're on such good terms with the publisher and editor there that he printed on the front page of his newspaper our grid. You see, he let the public know that we were coming. We weren't on the air yet. Well, I think we were still not on the air when I'm talking to Charlie Cook, right? Wow. We are not on the air yet, yes. But he's saying, this is what you could expect. You know, Morning Edition, All Things Considered. maybe Terry Gross. I'm not even sure. I'm not sure we had fresh air there at the time, you know. But it was some clincher of an argument, you know. But you see, I think that was a clincher to him. He said, my goodness, these are people who are going to be around for a while, you see. These are people for whom, if I got a member initiative grant, now member initiative is a very special roundabout way of saying what in public parlance sometimes comes across as pork barrel. You see what I mean? In other words, there are funds, and there are funds at the disposal in some sense, you know, not totally free disposal, right. but right. You know, if a senator or a representative sees something very worthwhile among his constituents, like a public radio station trying to get off the ground, he can say, why don't we put some funds behind this? You know, it'll be the Charlie Cook funds. Yeah. Now it was Charlie Cook plus, I think it was at least one other senator joined with him.
So we got fund, you got startup funds, mm-hmm. Radio Catskill, JFF, from at the county level and the state level.
We did. The county was a separate thing. That was
right.
NYPA stuff. Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
On the occasion of the 25th, looking back to the founding of the station, what was true then that is still true now that you want to be true 25 years from now? What was there then that you still see here now that you want to make sure people know about in the future?
Mm. Well, that's a big and fundamental question. I would go back to an answer I gave a bit earlier, which is overcoming, you might call it parochialism, or overcoming small localism, or overcoming xenophobia, overcoming the idea that, but you're from over there, and we're from over here, so that makes you an outsider. You see, you're not one of us, you see. Breaking down that series of kind of misunderstandings, you know, making everybody aware of what we have in common, and celebrating it, you know, hollering about it. I talk about hollering into Electro Voice RE20s.
Yeah, yelling into the can.
Yeah, yelling into the can, yeah. You know, there's one thing that I never tire of repeating, these Electro Voice RE20s. These are dynamite transponders or microphones. They're just incredibly good. And in fact, I would even make a little point about Linda Wertheimer. Linda Wertheimer is one of the major NPR voices and pronouncers of words who sits in front of these RE20s. And the best of them sit in front of RE20s because those are the best transponders around. Okay, now, Linda Wertheimer, somewhat sadly, from my point of view, is afraid to say the following word. And are you ready for this? I'll deliver it. NPR. NPR. She can try. Listen closely to Linda Wertheimer. She'll say it half a dozen times in the coming two or three or four weeks. NPR. Now, she's afraid to say the P because it might be a popping P, you see. Might be a popping P. And now, if you had an inferior microphone, it would be a popping P. You and I have all heard P's get popped, right? It sounds awful. It's too explosive, right? But the RE20 is too smart, you see, to get caught off guard by a P that got popped. So you see, Linda could be more uninhibited. She could say NPR. She'd say P, Peter Pepper picked a peck of pickled peppers. She could say all those things with a whole bunch of pop P's, and the Electro Voice RE20s would handle all of them, and nothing would be amiss.
Do you remember the day you went on air?
Well, now, actual going on air, the big one. I think it was the 12th of February, 1990. I think I have that right. It was whenever Glenn Waddell stepped right up in front of a Electro Voice RE20 and said, we always used to have to announce in the morning because we went on the air at 5:55 in the morning. Then we went off the air at midnight, you know, so there were rather ceremonious ceremonies involved in, you know, this is with studios and offices in Jeffersonville, New York, tower and transmitter.
It's located up on Elk Point Road in Liberty, New York.
There we
Broadcasting on frequencies of 90.5 megahertz.
Right.
But I used to have, to say it every Wednesday night to shut down the station.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
We sure.
But it was the legal, you know, sign-on, sign-off language.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we were very aware that you don't play fast and loose with legal IDs, right?
Not yeah, yeah.
You want to do it right.
So there was this moment when the first one got read. We've got it on tape, and we play it on special occasions like we've got.
Come on.
And Glenn reading it. Like, were you on hand when that happened? Were you here that morning?
I feel sure I wasn't more than a few meters away, but I don't have a vivid memory picture of it. I don't know if I was 10 meters away.
Is there anything else that you want folks to know on this occasion?
No. I think if we can continue this work of, you know, getting a broad scale message out of, you know, makes us all brothers and sisters. That's one of the things that you see. I remember vividly Christopher Hitchens appearing at a Harvard auditorium. And the first words out of his mouth when he stood up were, brothers and sisters. He was addressing his audience. He said, brothers and sisters. In fact, I asked him to autograph. It was a book signing thing. And I asked him to sign it fraternally. See, fraternally. And he hesitated a little bit because, or at least he hesitated. But you see, I quoted him as having called me a brother, you see. A brother or a sister. And so I had him where I wanted him, so to speak. But I wanted him to autograph one for Kevin Greff, because I bought a second copy, you see. And I wanted to say for him to say fraternally there, too. And there he hesitated, you see, because he didn't know how fraternal he felt toward Kevin.
Because he wasn't in the audience.
Exactly. He wasn't. Yeah. So he had me where he wanted me. Christopher wasn't an easy guy to outmaneuver in argument. May he rest. Yeah.
So that's why you call folks a...
Brother and sister, yeah. I find it kind of... It's also a leveling kind of thing.
In terms of interpersonal interactions or in exchange of ideas, we can start to approach each other at the same level.
Sure, at the same level. There's a photo that's... When Barack Obama was being visited by a very young boy, he said, "Is your hair like my hair?" He was an African-American young boy, very young. He was in the Oval Room of the White House. And he said, is your hair like my hair? My hair, the kid asked that, see. And so Obama, a rather tall guy, he bent over and he said, "Run your fingers through it, dude." He called him dude, you see. Now, see, dude is leveling. And that picture is still up in the Oval Room, I think. Yeah, they snapped a photo of the dude running his fingers, you see. By Jiminy, his hair is similar. You
know. But there's some of that leveling in the going on here in the concept of JFF itself. Just let's get everybody on the same level here.
Sure, I think very emphatically so, you know. Let's say if you say Brother Richter, is there any ambiguity about whether Brother Richter is fraternal toward you, you see? No. Or Sister Schneider. You see what I mean? But then you want that to be infectious, you see? You want to say, okay. In fact, I got challenged by no lesser an intellect, and this is a serious intellect, than Christina Hearn. She tested me. She said, "Do you call him Brother Moon?" Now, that's Reverend Moon. Oh, and I once said Brother Cheney, meaning Dick Cheney. And that got quite a reaction on my listening, Brother Cheney. See, but there's certain people who might say they're out near the edge of the brotherhood. You know what I mean? Out near the edge. Brother Cheney and the pro-torture people.
Would that be what we'd call the periphery of the fraternity?
Yeah, now we're talking.
Okay, that's all the time that we have for this conversation with Malcolm Brown. It was recorded in 2015. It was part of Radio Catskill's 25th anniversary. There's so much more
to Malcolm and his life than we even got close to in the interview. The interview was really about the history of WJFF. So with that, I do want to read some excerpts from his obituary now, just to fill out some more of the picture for you. This isn't everything, but there's some ideas here that I'd like you to hear. Malcolm Spencer Brown passed from this life with courage and purpose November 3rd, 2021. He died peacefully at home, his wife Anne and daughter Melissa by his side. A Renaissance man, Brown moved easily from philosophy to mathematics to environmental and social justice work, an emeritus professor of Greek philosophy at Brooklyn College and scholar on the works of Plato. Brown was also a pioneer in renewable energy and community-led public radio. Born in Beirut, Lebanon, to missionary doctors Roswell and Enid Crump Brown on February 27, 1932, Brown was raised in Buffalo, New York, and married three times. With his first wife, Carol Gardner, he had three children, Duncan, Charlotte, and Lydia. With his second, Virginia Hayden, he had two, Melissa and Greg. He is survived by his wife of 37 years, Ann Larson. Malcolm was a pioneer in integrating computers in humanities research, transliterating Greek to machine-readable form throughout the 70s. Also in the 1970s and early 80s, Brown published and presented papers at scholarly conferences in the U.S., France, and England, and edited texts that are still in use in college classrooms. In the mid to late 80s, Malcolm and Anne developed a microhydro facility on a small dam in Jeffersonville, New York, negotiated a contract with the utility company, and founded community public radio station WJFF on adjacent land in 1990. Malcolm joined in the physical labor on all of these projects, along construction workers and many volunteers, and when it came time to hang the transmitter, he climbed up the tower with the engineer. He also took his turn doing on-air announcing with a particularly soothing yet confident on-air demeanor, leading one listener to comment, quote, "If I have to hear about the end of the world, I want to hear Malcolm's voice tell me," end quote. In 1992, Malcolm spent a year in post-communist Bulgaria, where he taught philosophy, while Anne established a library at a newly established liberal arts college, the American University of Bulgaria. On their return, they opened the Good Earth Health Food Store on Main Street in Jeffersonville. After several years, they moved to Hull, Massachusetts, where Malcolm championed wind power. In later years, Malcolm returned to his scholarly work, researching at Harvard University, visiting manuscript collections and scholars in Oxford, Helsinki, Amsterdam, Rome, Florence, and Venice. His scholarly website is youngersocrates.com, and it's still up, youngersocrates.com. And that full obituary is up at Tribute Archive, and you can find a link through wjffradio.org. Again, thank you so much for listening. I'm Jason Dole. Well, and that's going to do it for this morning's edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Jason Dole. I hope you enjoyed hearing this interview. And if you knew Malcolm, you know, he was a singular and unforgettable person. And I wish Ann Larson and his family all the best. And I wish Brother Malcolm safe travels and peaceful rest. And I thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned. We got Farm and Country coming up next.
Radio Catskill supporters include Grizzly Bagels, small-batch handmade New York-style bagels in Calicoon, New York. Available for pre-order, in-person pickup, or shipping within New York State. GrizzlyBagels.com. From the River Reporter newspaper in Narrowsburg, RiverReporter.com. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, and this year, once again, Thanksgiving is probably going to be a little different still for a lot of us. But one thing's not going to change, our annual Thanksgiving Day special, Turkey Confidential. We'll answer your cooking questions with incredible guests. David Chang and Priya Krishna, Patty Hinnich, Kenji Lopez-Alt, and Southern Baking Queen Cheryl Day. That's Turkey Confidential on Thanksgiving Day from 8 p.m.
Starting at noon on Radio Catskill.
And I'm in a place in my life where I'm trying to get to a place of healing and reconciliation with the way my ancestors were treated and with the way that I'm treated when I go into a bus or when I go into a train, when I go into a store and they follow me because I'm brown. I'm angry at those things, but I'm also trying my best to reconciliate and heal from those things.
Josue Rivas, standing strong on Standing Rock. The Janice Adams Show, Saturday at noon.
WJFF Jeffersonville.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit, taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org.